Welcome to the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Good afternoon, everybody. I am Janice Cook Newman, and I have the distinct pleasure of introducing Michael Krasny to all of you. Normally, I would be able to do this entirely off the cuff, but as I was telling Michael, 5 hours ago, I walked off the plane from India, and so I had to make some notes because who knows what would come out of my mouth otherwise. Most of you know Michael Krasny as the voice on the radio asking all the smart questions, and we authors in particular think of Michael as very smart because he is one of the very, very few interviewers who actually reads our books before he interviews us. And I cannot tell you how rare that is. Others of you may know Michael as an author himself. He is a memoirist and a nonfiction writer on topics such as agnosticism and spirituality. A lucky few of us know Michael as Dr. Krasny, and have been one of his students in the English department at San Francisco State. I myself have had that opportunity. When I went back to state for my own MFA in creative writing, I sat in on Michael's class on the short story, and it was really remarkable because you not only get to hear him discuss all the merits and the crafts of the short stories, but he has anecdotes about the various authors who have written them that he's interviewed. So it's a really, really great experience. But I personally have been particularly fortunate to have been friends with Michael for some years. We meet for lunch about monthly. We talk about what we're reading. We talk about what we're working on. I got to hear a lot of this wonderful new book, Let There Be Laughter, as Michael was working on it. And that was a special treat because most of hearing about that book, sneaking behind me. First I thought I was imagining them. That's how jet lagged I am. But most of the thing about hearing about Michael's work on this book was that I would go to lunch and he would entertain me with these Jewish jokes, which is really a wonderful experience. It is now your turn to be entertained and enlightened by Michael Krasny, because it is my very great pleasure, and I'm going to admit one of the very few things that I would be delighted to do on the day that I had flown home from India, which is to introduce Michael Krasny to all of you.
Thank you to Janice, and is this mic on? Good, okay. And thank you all for being here. You know, she just got off a plane from India. I just got out of a hospital with a kidney stone. You know, these things do come up unexpectedly. I was reminded, though, just for a little laughter or levity, how many of you remember Wendy Takuda, who used to be on CBS? Yeah, she was actually married to the son of the guy who was the game show host of Let's Make a Deal, Monty Hall. And, you know, they have that chit-chat sometimes before they go on the air between the two anchors, the male anchor and the female anchor. Usually it's pretty vapid. But Wendy had just recently given birth, and the male anchor said, "Oh, Wendy, you just had a baby. What was it like to have a baby?" I mean, kind of threw her an easy line because it had no doubt been rehearsed, and it no doubt was not an original line of Wendy's, with all due respect. She said, "Well, it was a little bit like taking your upper lip and putting it over your head." And then she paused, and with really good timing, she said, "But compared to a kidney stone, which I also recently had, it's a walk in the park, so bear that in mind." So let me talk a bit about my book. Some of you who've listened to me on the radio all these years, and it's going on 25 in February, and remarkably enough, yeah. But I've even been a literature professor longer than that. At San Francisco State recently, they honored me with a Lifetime Achievement Award, and honestly, my Morden thought, and this is sort of Jewish humor in a way, was This is what we call a pre-mortem award, you know. Because you do tend to get these awards sometime, Academy Awards and the like, Pulitzers and so forth, and they think, well, it's lifetime achievement. Maybe this is the end of the line. We should give it to him. But I wanted to kind of go outside of my comfort zone. I've been talking about news for so many years and literature, which are both really very serious topics. There's a lot of comedic literature, but when you think about it, so much of it is downbeat or political. Sometimes those are simultaneously the same. And I really felt that I like Brecht's line, Bertolt Brecht, the German playwright, who said, "The man who laughs has not yet been told the terrible news." And I sort of ingested that line and thought, well, you know, there is a lot to laugh at, especially in Jewish humor. And I'd always wanted to be a Jewish novelist, but I had the chops to get a PhD in literature, but not to be the novelist like Bellow or Roth or Malamud, those three writers who were referred to back in my day as Harch after Marx by Sal Bellow. So I thought I had a book in me. I'd done a book about honor, and I did a couple of previous nonfiction books, one a memoir, which I was probably too young to write, called Memoir of Talk Radio and Literary Life. The title was Off Mic. And then I did a book which was a seeking book, which some of you may know, called Spiritual Envy, which really came out of my desire to find out what I believed. And it turned out to be sort of an agnostic primer. It wasn't intended to be that. But, and by the way, some great jokes about agnosticism in that book, though it's a very serious book. Mortzahl came up with the line that a family of agnostics moved in a neighborhood and somebody burned a question mark on their front lawn. There was also actually an interview I did with Studs Terkel, and I realized a few years ago, there's sort of a sobering realization that I probably have done more interviews now than Studs Terkel did in his career. And Studs Terkel said, I'm an agnostic. What that means is I'm a cowardly atheist, essentially. So. But I really was lucky to come out with this book, which was kind of a diversion in some ways. It wasn't meant to be a joke book. It was meant to be sort of a study of Jewish humor and what it means, and to get behind it and to deconstruct it, and not only to work with jokes, which Freud really was very instructive in telling us that jokes are mirrors and portals to our unconscious, whether that's collective unconscious of Jews or whether that's just human being universal unconscious. I mean, jokes do reflect anxiety. Freud was right, wrong about a lot of things, but he was, I think, right about this. They reflect often or sublimate aggression and repress sexuality and all of those kinds of things. So I found myself looking for what jokes mean, but also trying to write a book that was funny and that would create laughter. And I really wanted to, you know, bring laughter to the world and to myself for all those years of taking on such serious topics. And I realized that there are some serious motifs and themes when it comes to understanding Jewish humor. Sometimes Jewish humor crosses borders. It's not necessarily simply insular or sui generis Jewish humor in any way. In fact, I'll tell you an instructive story along those lines. I'm always super aware of trying not to be a name dropper. But, you know, I had a student who said to me a few years ago, Professor Cressy, if you got names to drop, why don't you drop them, you know? Because I was sort of inhibited about mentioning names and sounding. They do have the privilege and the honor and the good fortune of meeting and socializing and also having on the air, you know, some extraordinary people. So it just so happens that out of actually getting to know from interviewing, I became friendly over the years with Amy Tan and her husband Lou De Matai. And they had us, my wife and I, over one night, and Amy knows I'm a joke collector. And I'm going to tell you the joke that I knew, and then I'm going to tell you the joke that Amy told me, so you see how these things can cross over. The joke that I knew went something like this. There's a barber, and he opens up a new barber shop, and he has a barber pole and all kinds of fanfare and whatnot, hoopla. And the first customer who comes in is a priest. And he gives the priest a haircut to the priest's specifications, and the priest says, let me pay you for your haircut. How much is it? He says, no. You're a man of God. You're a man of the cloth. I'm not going to charge you anything. Consider this a free haircut, but please come back. Next day, the priest goes out and goes to get the newspaper, and there's a beautiful crucifix there with gratitude signed by the priest. And then a minister comes in, and the same exact thing replicates. He gives the minister a haircut. Minister goes to pay him. He says, no. You're a man of the cloth. I don't take money from ministers. And he says, okay. Next day, he goes out to get the newspaper. There's a Bible out there and subscribed with thanks and gratitude from the minister. And a rabbi comes in, gets a haircut and the same thing, and he goes out to get his newspaper, and there are 12 rabbis out there. Okay, so the joke may be a little bit of discomforting in some ways because, you know, it suggests that old canard about, a stereotype about Jews always, you know, looking for a bargain or something. But Amy Tan tells me this joke, and it's a Frenchman, a German, and a Chinese guy, and it's 12 Chinese guys who are out there. So you see how these jokes often have a universal quality to them. And what I wanted to discover and what I was setting out to discover was what is specifically Jewish in humor, and what does it tell us? What does it really tell us in a cultural anthropologic way, but also about the history of this particular tribe of people? And I certainly discovered a lot of major themes, serious themes or motifs. A lot of them have to do with differentness, with just the idea that we're Jews because, you know, chosen people, which my father told me when I was a boy, does not mean you're special. It means we were chosen by God to take the Torah. But there are a lot of Jews who believe otherwise and are chauvinistic. And a lot of the humor is chauvinistic, and a lot of the humor is stereotypical. And a lot of it goes up against the stereotypes, and a lot of them, the humor actually pushes in different ways the stereotypes in different directions. But a lot of the humor has to do with not only separateness, but also loss, as you might imagine, and memorializing things of the past. Let me give you a little trajectory here that will be very instructive, I hope. There's, you know what Yiddishkeit is. Yiddishkeit means Yiddish culture, and the shtetl, that is, you know, all you know, fiddler on the roof, right? That world of the shtetl is the world of Yiddishkeit. They spoke Yiddish, you know. There's a joke in my book about a convention of Esperanto speakers, you know, that universal language that George Bernard Shaw and others were devoted to. The only problem was all the people who were in the Esperanto convention happened to speak Yiddish. Okay, so it's a sort of an in-joke in some ways. But Yiddish reflects so much of Jewish culture. Ashkenazi, not Ladino so much, not, you know, the other sects that are identified, Eastern European geographically for the most part. But think of a joke like this, and it's so revealing. It's a standard classic joke. A couple of Jews are lined up in front of a firing squad, which really wasn't all that anomalous in the shtetl. They'd be plucked out and they'd be persecuted and sometimes obviously murdered. And one says to the next, "Say, don't we get a last request? I'm going to ask for a cigarette." And the other one goes, "Shh, you don't want to get us in trouble." Now, it's a disturbing joke, but it's a funny joke. You know, and again, it confronts something that's certainly verboten and disarming in many ways. But then you fast forward to a joke which I first heard from, anybody remember the comedian Bobby Slayton? Yeah, he worked here in San Francisco for a while. Now he's in Los Angeles. He used to call himself Yid Vicious. Instead of Sid Vicious, the punk rocker. So Bobby told this joke, and it was a joke about, a lot of these jokes have different nationalities with Jews, but this is about a Frenchman, a German, and a tough New York Jew, and it has to be seen as a tough New York Jew to realize how far the trajectory has been from the shtetl. And they're captured by a band of cannibals. These premises are always fascinating. And the cannibals take them into a village, and there in the village, in this remote Amazonian village, is a big kettle, a big pot, boiling with vegetables. And a guy steps out in the loincloth, and he says, "I'm the leader of the cannibal tribe. Obviously, I speak fluent English. You all understand English. I'm going to tell you what we're going to do. We're going to eat you, first of all, because we're cannibals. But aside from that, after we kill you, we're going to take your skin and make it into a beautiful canoe for our tribe, and it'll be used generationally, transgenerationally, one generation after another, in our tribe as a way of mobility and transportation. And not only that, but we're so enlightened, we're going to let you choose the way you want to die." He asks the Frenchman, "How do you want to die?" And the Frenchman, figuring this is impossible that they would have, he says, "Guillotine." And the leader of the tribe takes an axe, a small axe, out of his loincloth and chops the Frenchman's head off. He says to the German, "How do you want to die?" And the German says, "A Luger." Figuring there's no way he would have a Luger, takes a pistol out of his loincloth and just shoots the German to death. And then he asks the tough New York Jew, "How do you want to die?" And the tough New York Jew says, "Give me a fork." He says, "A fork?" He says, "Yeah, give me a fork. You got a fork? You got one of those forks? Any fork will do." He says, "I happen to have some utensils here in my loincloth too. I carry lots of things. Here's a fork." Takes the fork, starts stabbing himself, says, "Here's your goddamn canoe." All right, so. Now. From the shtetl to, you know, are we going to ask for this last request? Don't want to get in trouble, to that kind of toughness, sometimes a mask for toughness and so forth, we see a real trajectory. We see it also in, let me give you another example right out of my book. And the book is not just a joke book. It really does try to go into a kind of analysis of these jokes. So three modern rabbis are arguing about which of the three is the most progressive. I am definitely the most progressive, says the first rabbi. We allow smoking during services. That's nothing, replies the second rabbi. We serve pork spareribs during Yom Kippur. Not bad, replies the third rabbi, but I have you all beat. Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, or as I came from Cleveland, it was a fish holiday, we said Yom Kippur. Not bad, he says, but I have you all beat. During Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we post signs at my temple closed for the holidays. Okay. That, it's a funny joke, but it's also dealing with some very serious material, loss, assimilation, the eroding of piety. All of those kinds of things come into a joke like that. And the idea is to really release it in a kind of cathartic way, as far as I'm concerned, and the joke succeeds in that way. And certainly, a lot of jokes really follow along that line. Let me go back, though, to Yiddishkeit, because I realize there was a lot of rhythm and pattern from Yiddish culture, Yiddishkeit again, that made its way into American humor. And the two were really very strongly linked. American humor has a lot to do with Jewish humor, right up through Seinfeld and right up through, you know, Rodney Dangerfield and so many figures that we associate with the more Larry David contemporary period. I could have, by the way, almost as easily written a eulogy with this book to certain kinds of Jewish humor, but I realize that some of it, especially the irony and the paradoxical nature of it and what's so embedded in so much of it, is still with us. There's a kind of fast firing, for example. People don't tell jokes as much as they used to. Stand-up comics do a lot of narrative and so forth. But I remember interviewing the great Yiddish novelist, Isaac Bashevis Singer, Nobel Prize-winning laureate. And I said to him, I was a very solemn young man. I said, Mr. Singer, do you believe in free will? And he said, I have no choice. You know, there was that, that kind of profound meaning that was communicated there in the subtext, obviously. But at the same time, it's the rhythm of it. It's the kind of Henny Youngman stuff that many of us remember. You know, Henny, I went to the doctor. The doctor said, you're sick. I said, I want another opinion. Okay, you're ugly. You know, it just goes like that. There are so many of those kind of jokes that are tied to Yiddishkeit. I went to my rabbi. I said, Rabbi, why are so many people so apathetic and so ignorant? I don't know and I don't care. You know, it just goes like that. Even has a lot of jokes with, three older Jewish ladies sitting, and Jewish women get, I want to talk about this in a moment, but they get a lot of the brunt of Jewish humor, because a lot of these Jewish jokes were, I'm convinced, made up by Jewish men, and it was a release of their aggression, and sometimes the misogyny came out and so forth, although I have a different take on them too, as a feminist. But let me just give you an example. Three older Jewish women sitting in a restaurant, waiter walks up and says, is anything all right? All right, so you have that sense of ridicule, and ridicule based on stereotype. Now, there's no question about it. But the laughter really gets at the recognition that the stereotype is what makes us laugh. And although some of these jokes, especially, you know, I started thinking about all of the jokes that really, especially the Jewish American princess jokes, which in some ways are not only misogynistic probably by any standards, but also anti-Semitic. Some of them are pretty funny, though. You know, there's no escaping it. And, you know, some people will say, as long as there's humor to derive, you know, it shouldn't matter. Well, sometimes it does matter. You don't want to hurt people's feelings. You've got to be selective, and I write about this, at who you're telling a story, anecdote, or joke to. And the book is filled with both, as well as folklore and other things. But that sensitivity, you know, well, let me give you an example. This is a joke, before I get back to, the princesses. This is a joke, it's a classic Jewish joke, and I think it's very funny. But Ruth Weiss, who is a professor of comparative literature at Harvard, who also wrote a book on Jewish humor, and I had on my program forum, much more scholarly book in many ways than mine, although I try to delve into the scholarship, but she goes back to a lot of the Yiddish writers and so forth. So she tells this joke. And some of you may know the joke, because I said it's a classic joke. It's another different nationality. Sorry. So you have a German, a Frenchman, a Mexican, and a Jew, and they climb a very arduous hill. And they're tired, you know, and they get to the top of it, and they rest for a moment, and the German says, I'm tired, I'm thirsty, I must have a beer. And the Frenchman says, I'm tired, I'm thirsty, I must have wine. And the Mexican says, I'm tired, I'm thirsty, I must have tequila. And the Jew says, I'm tired, I'm thirsty, I must have diabetes. Okay, so... So Ruth Weiss told this joke, and there were some non-Jewish people who said, Isn't that an offensive joke? And in some ways, of course, it is. I mean, it says that Jews are kvetchy and they are much too hypochondriacal and all those kinds of things. They don't drink as much. There are a lot of stereotypes that are embedded in that joke. At the same time, it's funny. So again, where do you draw the line and where do you decide it's funny and therefore, and we've gone again in a whole different number of trajectories, which I try to trace in the book and get into, including something that was so verboten that it couldn't even be made fun of. Remember after 9/11, there was no humor really permitted. It was impermissible to be funny on David Letterman or on Jay Leno. And eventually things started to sort of seep in a little bit here and there, but there was total discomfort at first. That's the way it was with the Shoah, the Holocaust, for many years. And then Mel Brooks came, you know, hit the springtime for Hitler, and Larry David really pushed the envelope even more and Curb Your Enthusiasm. He has some guy who's a survivor of Auschwitz meeting up with a guy who's from the TV show Survivor, you know, and the TV show guy is complaining about, you know, wearing thongs and mosquitoes and so forth. And this guy, Solly, who's a friend of Larry's father, said, I was in Auschwitz, you know. I mean, it's like nothing is sacrosanct anymore. And American humor does really push the envelope. I shouldn't say nothing is sacrosanct because for some people, things are indeed remain sacrosanct. But when Ruth Weiss was asked, isn't that joke insulting and isn't it a joke that shouldn't be told, especially to people who aren't Jewish and so forth? She said, well, it depends on how they respond to it, you know. And a lot of the way jokes affect us or humor affects us has to do with the kind of response. I mean, there's a classic Jewish-American princess joke. And it's one of the more benign ones. It's about a Jewish-American princess who's in Tiffany's. And she's looking at a vase which is invaluable, and it slips out of her hand. It crashes into hundreds of pieces. And you know what she says? She says, I'm all right. This is a whole subgenre of jokes, and what they encapsulate is sort of like, you know, and I think the Jewish-American princesses now are grandmothers, many of them, but it encapsulates a whole sensibility that ascribes to them all sorts of characteristics that say they're spoiled and they're materialistic and usually they don't like sex. And as I said, it comes out from this often aggressive husband stuff. But I started thinking about them, and a lot of them, you know, like the famous one about Jewish-American princess dies and, her husband dies and she says... the will says that his ashes should go in Bloomingdale's. He shouldn't, he's a pious Jew. Why is he even asking to be cremated? And the lawyer who's doing this, who's the executive of the estate, says, well, the reason is he knows you'll visit him at least a couple times a week. His ashes are in Bloomingdale's. So there's that kind of, you know, that kind of humor. But you kind of deconstruct it, and what you realize is it's a celebrative sense of, we've made it, you know. Jewish patriarchy has allowed for spoiling our daughters and our wives as princesses, and there's a different side to it that really needs to be taken into account. I had to realize this with a lot of the jokes that I deconstructed. For example, there's a joke about Pope John Paul. Again, it's a classic joke. We've been through Benedict, and now Francis is Pope, but you may remember the Polish Pope, John Paul. And John Paul, when he was Pope, the joke goes, decided to do some decorating in the Vatican. So he brings in, first, a fellow countryman, a Polish decorator, and the Polish decorator takes measurements and so forth and says, Your Holiness, I'll do this whole job for $3,000. And the Pope says, break that down for me. He says, well, it's $1,000 for the labor, $1,000 for the material, and $1,000 for me to do the job. Okay, Pope says, I'll get back to you. I want a couple more estimates. Gets an Italian decorator in. The Italian decorator goes through the same motions, all the measurements, and says, I'll do the job for $6,000, Pontiff. And the Pope says to him, break it down. He says, $2,000 for labor, $2,000 for material, and $2,000 for me to do the job. I'll get back to you. Brings in a Jewish decorator. Jewish decorator says, $9,000 the whole job. The Pope says, well, how does that break down? He says, well, three for you, three for me, three for the Polish decorator. Okay. Now, you look at that on the face of it, and it suggests, you know, again, a kind of Jewish chauvinism with money and all the rest of it, all these things that make a lot of Jews uncomfortable, understandably so, and everything. But at the same time, it's chauvinistic, you know, like a lot of these jokes are. And yet, I have a close Polish friend who said to me, you know, what that joke really reveals is the only honest one is the Pole. And I thought, absolutely. Did you say?
5 minutes.
Oh, 5 minutes. I haven't even, I'm just getting wound up. No, I mean, there's something that's following me here. Pardon? I'll tell you what. I'll get to the questions after I get to something that's vital in all this discussion. That is, what is significantly, what is singularly Jewish in humor? And there are some jokes that just stand out. There's a British joke, for example, about the queen who's knighting a number of men, and they're leaning down in front of the queen, and one has a yarmulke, a skullcap, and she says, "Why is this night different than all other nights?" I mean, it's a classic joke. Any Jew who's had an experience with a Passover Seder knows Manishtana Halayla Hazeh, you know, all right. So jokes that incorporate Yiddishkeit, I mean, Japanese man is told that his wife is having an affair with a Jewish man. He decides to confront her. He says, "I've heard that you're having an affair with a Jewish man. Is this true? Who told you this, Mishigas?" You know, this is a lot of these jokes will bring Yiddish in, and Yiddish is kind of collectively recognized. And I told an anecdote in the book when I saw the Woody Allen film Love and Death, and suddenly, again, it's, you know, kind of sexist humor, but there's a collective connection with it. It's the early 70s, and he takes this woman's hand. He says, "It's a pleasure to meet the Countess Mieskite." And Mieskite is like an ugly-looking woman in Yiddish. But it's just the Yiddish, the sound of Yiddish, that resonates and that creates a kind of humor that's unmistakable. Even just the intonations of Yiddish. Grandfather is with his grandson. They see a big sign. They're going for a walk, holding hands. They see a big sign. It says, "No swimming allowed." It says it with exclamation marks. Big, huge letters twice, "No swimming allowed." Grandfather says, "Come on, we're going to go for a swim." Grandpa says, but Zeta, Grandpa, look, it says no swimming allowed. It says it twice, in big, huge letters twice. No, it says no swimming allowed. No, swimming allowed. Okay, so you take, okay. Those of you who know your Yiddish locutions and know the patterns of, but we've moved in a lot of different directions. And let me just end, I guess, because we are out of time. And thank you for, Well, the problem with my repertoire in Storehouse of Jewish Jokes is I could keep you here till 10 o'clock p.m., and I'm not going to do that. All right, but listen to how these jokes have changed, okay? Because they're not afraid anymore. Like Woody Allen came out with a line. He said, it's fairly early on in the late 50s, early 60s. He said, "You look at this gold watch. Isn't it beautiful? My grandfather, I cherish this watch. My grandfather sold it to me on his deathbed, you know." And suddenly there's a kind of unvarnished realization that you can put those things out there that, especially after the Shoah, were really forbidden. You're not supposed to talk about Jews as being money-grubbing or being, you know, materialistic or anything along those lines. Or especially having the power that, well, let me give you this joke. And it's a narrative in my book because, like I say, I'm a frustrated novelist, and at least in writing these up, I could put them into narrative. And this has an important sort of stylistic narrative to it. Two Texans are sitting on a plane. They're going to Dallas with an old Jewish man sitting between them. First Texan says, "My name is Roger. I own 250,000 acres. I have 1,000 head of cattle, and they call my place Jolly Roger." Second Texan says, "My name is John. I own 350,000 acres. I have 5,000 head of cattle. Call my place Big John's." They look down at the little old Jewish man who says, "My name is Lenny Leibowitz, and I own only 300 acres. Roger looks down at him and says, "300 acres? What do you raise?" "Nothing," says Lenny. "Well, then, what do you call it?" asks John. "Downtown Dallas." Sorry. But in some ways, I could conclude with that. Let me conclude with one other. All right, it's a famous joke, and it's the first joke in the book. Why is it the first joke in the book? I did an event. Some of you are New Yorker writers. I did an event with Calvin Trillin at the North Theater, where we cracked a lot of jokes and talked about Jewish humor. And my publisher said, "Can you do this? Can you get Trillin to do this in New York? I'll ask him." And I did, and he agreed, and I got Adam Gopnik, and I got Jeff Toobin to be the interviewer, and we got Patricia Marks. It was a wonderful evening at the 92nd Street Y. Yeah, I don't want to make it sleazy. There was a little Freudian slip there. Right. So, Bud Trillin, he's known to everybody, Calvin Trillin, is up there, and he says, "This joke could not translate into any other nationality. It's the first joke in my book." But I'm not sure he's right, because I've heard from some people who have read my book and written to me that this joke actually does or has surfaced in other cultures, and it may have been originally a Jewish joke. We don't know. You can't trace where these jokes come from or who originated them. Sometimes I think not only aggressive men, but a lot of men and some women with time, a lot of time on their hands. So this is the one about the Jewish grandmother, and it is in some ways distinctively Jewish, because Jewish mothers and Jewish grandmothers, we got helicopter mothers and we've got tiger mothers, but the Jewish mother remains a kind of archetypal figure in the literature and in the lore, and in the folklore particularly. So there's a Jewish grandmother taking her handsome young grandson to the beach. The boy is close to the incoming waves, and unexpectedly he gets knocked down by a powerful one and is washed out into the ocean. The Jewish grandmother, unable to swim, screams in terror that her grandchild is drowning, pleads for someone to save him, and prays to God for help. And as if God hears her anguished cries, a young muscular lifeguard appears and dives into the water. She, meanwhile, is still distraught, terrified that the child has been under the water too long to survive. The lifeguard brings the blue-looking little boy to shore and begins to administer mouth-to-mouth resuscitation on him while the grandmother continues to pray. Soon water spurts from the boy's mouth and he is breathing. The lifeguard reassures the grandmother that her grandson is going to be okay, whereupon the old lady nods, unclasps her hands from the prayer position, and says to the lifeguard, with a bit of an edge to her voice, "He had a hat." Okay. All right. I was going to end there, but since there wasn't raucous laughter, let me just weave one more. Because right. This is what I call a killer joke, and it faces all these forbidden kinds of things. And it also has to do with Jewish mothers. And I want to give you a different take on this as a what I like to call a card-carrying feminist, as I am. So the joke goes that a man is on his deathbed, and his daughter is by his side, and he's about to expire, maybe even just minutes away. And suddenly the father speaks and he says, "I smell kugel," you know, which is this wonderful Jewish noodle dish. And the daughter says, "Yeah, mom is making a kugel." He says, "Just to taste your mother's kugel once before I die." The daughter says, "Of course, daddy." She leaps up and goes into the kitchen. Meanwhile, he's hanging on by, you know, gossamer threads and really just almost a shade just ready to come down. She comes back. She sits down. She folds her hands. He can barely even speak. "Where's the kugel?" He says, "Mom says it's for after." Okay. All right, you know, it's not a nice joke, right? And, I mean, there's a Jewish version of it. Mom says it's for the Shiva. However, I started thinking about this joke and all the jokes that have to do with how tough-minded Jewish women are. You know, husband dies, wife calls the newspaper and says, "I want to put an obituary in for my husband." "Okay, but we pay by the word." She says, "All right, Mort died, Volvo for sale." You know, all right. But you take those kind of jokes, and what you realize is, what were women doing in the shtetl? For the most part, they were providing an earning which put food on the table. The men were Luftmenschen. They were often studying, trying to get closer to apprehending God. They were studying Talmud, Torah, and so forth. It wasn't like Tevye out there, you know, with the dairyman work and so forth. It was, in fact, often simply studying all the time. And the women were really heroic, you know, because somebody had to put food on the table. They took in or they went out and did knitting and sitting and all these kinds of things, baking goods, whatnot. And the fact of the matter is that these jokes reflect in a strange way. They're aggressive, but they also reflect that kind of practical-minded sense. I'm not trying to impose, you know, a feminist interpretation on this. I really think that it's there underlying, maybe buried to some extent from what's out in front of the jokes, but it's there. I was going to tell a few sex jokes, but I think I should probably wind it up. I'm going over on time here. Actually, you've been, as the comedians always say, you've been a terrific audience, and thank you so much for that. Sex jokes are kind of upbeat to end on and funny, but there may be some questions, so that's what we do now. We entertain any questions. Glad to...
No, I can't do that.
Hear what's on your mind or any questions you want.
Thank you.
So, like I said, there's no end to them. The problem is, I'll tell you what, actually. The problem is when you know as many jokes as I've collected through a lifetime, you begin to realize that there aren't that many that you haven't heard. You know, I used to say, as a literature professor, I used to say there are maybe 9 plots and variations on those plots. There may be 8 or 9 jokes and variations on the jokes, too. But I got a couple that I really wanted to get in the book that I hadn't heard. So if you want to hear those, we can conclude it. All right, but before I do that, I actually got one over the transom the other day that I hadn't heard. It came from some reader of the book in Denver. And I thought, it's actually a brilliant joke in many ways about all these Jews who convert to become Quakers. And the leader of the Quaker group says to the rabbi, you know, some of my best Jews are friends. Okay, so. You have something? I don't know if you've been awake during this whole thing. No, you haven't. You've been asleep, which is always very courteous and complimentary, but you have a question nonetheless. Pardon? You were meditating with your eyes closed. Were you hearing me? No. Would you take a quiz? No, I'm sorry. Did you actually have a question? I don't mean to be as ruthless.
Why do so many jokes have threes in them?
Why do they have so many have
threes, three tests, three wishes, three tries, three... Why are there threes in jokes?
I'm still not understanding.
Why are there threes? Like...
That's not just Jewish jokes. That's often... It goes back to mythology and ancient stories. You know, the king with the three... Many of you know those stories. The three daughters, the three sons, because you can actually... You can do, it's like, I remember a student asking me, why is Waiting for Godot have only two acts? And the reason is because there's a kind of a thesis and an antithesis. There's no synthesis. I know that sounds very Marxist and Hegelian, but the truth is you can have a thesis and an antithesis and a synthesis. You can have one thing going against the other, and then you can have something that results from those two. So, any other questions?
Yeah.
All right, because I was willing to tell some more jokes, but if there are questions, I'd rather hear the questions. No, I'd rather hear the questions, actually, honestly. They've got the mic up there.
Thank you both for your wonderful humor and your extraordinary program on KQED.
Which thank you.
I want to raise a note that's more serious, which is I have a theory that Jewish humor thrives in society at large when anti-Semitism seems to diminish. But alas, on college campuses, many young people are even afraid to identify themselves as Jews. At the university where you taught, San Francisco State, Jews were not permitted into a conference on minority rights, even though they make up about
2%. I'm well aware of that. Thanks.
San Francisco State, this past week at UC Santa Cruz, some of the minorities that Jews have fought very hard for shouted epithets, not just against Israel or Israeli policies, but against Jews. And people on campuses, correspondingly, I'm wondering about the future of sharing Jewish humor in climates that are so hostile. And I wonder about if you concur with my theory that this kind of humor works for the public at large when anti-Semitism diminishes, as it did after the Holocaust, but now is coming back with a vengeance.
Yeah, you've posed a very, I think, significant and in many ways sobering, troubling question. Thank you for it. I don't have any glib answers. I think anti-Semitism is coming back thanks to the alt-right and thanks to, you know, the real realization I had when the book was published was a lot of people really desperately wanted humor, especially in the Bay Area, because they were depressed about Trump's victory. And humor actually is good for the soul and good to reduce stress and good for our immune system, I believe. There's a whole article in a recent issue, in fact, of Phi Beta Kappa Journal, American Scholar. It's not so empirically proven, but it's good hypothetical. I came to the conclusion that a lot of Jewish humor is tied to the golem. Some of you know the story of the golem in the Czech or the Prague ghetto. It was this creature, like a Frankenstein creature created by man, and it was both defensive and offensive. That is, it could be used to ward off those who were on the attack. And humor is necessary for that, but it could also be used in an offensive way. And you have a lot of Jewish humor that follows that. Think about Don Rickles, who recently passed away, or Jackie Leonard, or even Howard Stern, Joan Rivers. It's more of an aggressive attack dog type of humor, making fun of and ridiculing and so forth. And some of it's very funny. So the Jewish people have always been walking a very thin line in terms of how to make fun of things that can be very painful. I think you're right to raise the fact that there's more to be serious about now, especially on the college campuses, and more to be painful. there's this line that's drawn often between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. And frankly, I think that you're getting into more merging of the two than we've seen in quite a while. And, you know, this is just an opinion for what it's worth. But it's always struck me as somebody who certainly has been very much concerned about the rights of Palestinians and, frankly, the justice for the Palestinians, and go back a long way with giving them a voice on the radio. It's always concerned me, though, that a lot of the hatred that's directed against Israel, and you know, Israel, especially under a right-wing regime now, is is nothing to be ecstatic about under Netanyahu and Likud. But it strikes me that I wonder sometimes, and I'm sure many people who are Jewish wonder, even people who are sympathetic totally, even to a greater degree, to the Palestinian cause, what the hatred is all about, which focuses on Israel and not on Syria under Assad and not on the Congo and not on, go back to Cambodia under Pol Pot, go back to Bosnia, so many, I mean, for a long time, and I'm sorry to say, because it's where my roots are, a lot of it does come from the left. And I wrestle with this. I'm being very honest with you, total, you know, transparent, confessional about it. I've been trying to get a hold of it and get a sense of it. I talk to many students, many of my own students, who, you know, I've asked to be candid with me about this. And what are their real feelings? What are their true feelings? And some of them have said, you know, that I've got to be honest with you. You know, I have some of those stereotypes in my head. So, do Jews who are using humor as a defense or an offense heighten those stereotypes? It's a valid and a vital question. Can they be used against Jews? All stereotypes can be used against people. But you know, when I think about somebody like Don Rickles, he would talk and he couldn't get away with any of it today, literally. I mean, the jokes he made about blacks and Chinese, and we go into the audience and Jews and any ethnic group, we're in too politically correct a stage. And Monty Python's John Cleese, who I had on my show not too long ago, said, Michael, I can't even go on campuses anymore. It's too politically correct. I can't do the humor. Seinfeld has said it. Chris Rock has said it. Is this good or is this bad? I'll let you be the judge. But comedians who have worked that kind of humor now feel that they can't do it because it sounds like hate speech, or somebody interprets it as being hate speech. We're into some very, you know, nuanced and thin territories here, and it takes a great deal of, it seems to me, serious almost meditation to realize where we are. But I didn't mean it. I wrote this book to be funny. Getting into some serious territory here. Let me tell you actually just something really funny. I'll shift gears here because I don't want you to leave in any... I want you to think. That's what I, you know, why I do the program I do every day. But there's even, you know, I found myself doing research on some of the comedians I interviewed for this book. And I had the good fortune of interviewing Jackie Mason and Joan Rivers and Alan King and Larry David, and a host of really some of the finest Jewish comedians. And when I was doing research on Alan King, I discovered something, and I thought, I laughed out loud, and I laughed because it was so silly. And I thought, you know, what we need sometimes is just silliness. I'll tell you, it's a real story. I'll tell you what happened. So Alan King is performing at Windsor Castle for Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip. And after the show is over, he goes back in behind the stage, and the Queen and the Prince come to see him, and he's thrilled, you know. And Queen Elizabeth shakes his hand and says, it's a pleasure to meet you, Mr. King. And he says, it's a pleasure to meet you, Mrs. Queen. Now, I thought, silly, you know, and maybe even kind of dumb. But at the same time, it made me laugh out loud. And I thought, why not have that kind of humor? I wanted the book to really be serious in many ways. And you're raising some of the more serious questions that I hope I do raise in the book. But I also wanted it to create a lot of hilarity and laughter. And so far, it seems to have, at least from what I've been able to discern. Well, thank you for your attention. I really appreciate it.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.